Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, well, when I was first invited to give this talk, I had mixed feelings. On the one hand, I was immensely flattered, really I was, but also, false modesty aside, I thought I did have some useful observations to make about propaganda narratives. If I thought I had nothing to bring to the table, I would have declined the invitation. I did have some deep-seated fears, though. I'm not a very experienced public speaker, and I was a bit worried. How shall I put it? I was worried that I might suck. Well, I suppose I'm not the first person to have that fear, as you could relate to that. But, we must face our fears, and I was very determined not to suck, so I set about the task of putting together a talk that would be thought-provoking, witty, entertaining. That was the idea. But as days went by, I found I was getting very blocked. A voice in my head kept saying, "Don't suck, don't suck. Whatever you do, don't suck." It turned out that this was not very helpful, and I was just getting more and more blocked. Well, finally, the way I got unblocked was via radical shift in perspective. I inverted the whole question. Instead of thinking about how not to suck, I thought about it this way. Suppose I really set out deliberately to bore the living shit out of you. How would I go about that? Well, could I do a good Noam Chomsky impersonation? I don't think that's an option. You know how 007 James Bond has a license to kill? Chomsky also has that. Well, not with a gun, which would be more merciful. He's licensed to bore you to death. I think he keeps it in his billfold next to his driver's license, but I don't have that intellectual icon mojo, so which is just as well, I suppose. But seriously, one thing that I would consider to be pretty boring would be to drone on for 30 minutes in some very nerdy, geeky way about why various propaganda narratives are not truthful. 9/11, Kennedy assassination, start going on about the trajectory of the bullets and the head wound and. Well, to be clear, I don't mean to say that that there's no place for that, but it has been beaten to death, and I personally don't have anything new to bring to that discussion. I also don't think it would be that much interest for my audience today, some litany about all these various propaganda narratives are not true. I just assume that you guys get that. Lee Harvey Oswald, Osama bin Laden and the 19 hijackers, Alibaba and the 40 thieves with their flying carpets. Yeah, by the way, there is no political movement in the Middle East that has the slightest interest in massacring some random homosexuals in a gay bar in Orlando, Florida. Just as for example, I'm pretty sure of that. I'd be like, what, kill a commie for Christ, kill a queer for Muhammad. Yeah, it's all bullshit. We get that. At the very least, this talk is based on the presumption that we do. You see, at this point in my own development, that these things are false, is not that interesting to me. I'm well past that. Nowadays, what fascinates me is how the matrix, the propaganda matrix, this massive machine that exists to maintain this entire fraudulent edifice, how does it work? You have these stories that, if you examine them at all closely, have zero factual basis, yet they acquire this presumption of truth in people's minds. I know they do because I believe these things myself for most of my life, and probably just about everybody I knew believed them as well. I stopped believing at some point, but I'm not ex exactly sure why, to tell the truth. Now, it's not like I'm presuming to give you some pat answer to these questions either. It lies sort of at the nexus of various fields, psychology, culture. Though I increasingly feel it's largely about narrative, how storytelling works, myths, legends. Now, one thing about belief in these things is that we don't know for sure who actually does believe. We just know who says they do. They may or may not believe. After all, it's understood that if any mainstream public figure stands up and says he doesn't believe certain things, that's career suicide, right? Let's consider a specific case. There's this guy, Jeffrey St. Clair, a current editor of Counterpunch. About a year ago, he wrote some rant there about so-called conspiratorial left, also called these people deep staters. The tone of the piece is quite derisive. I guess we shouldn't take this personally. Actually, I think we should take it personally. I'm pretty sure he was talking about us. St. Clair went on to say, quote, "Of course, I remain an unrepentant magic bullet man." You know, just to quickly refresh people's memories, the magic bullet is that one bullet that caused seven different wounds on two different people, according to the Warren Commission report on the Kennedy assassination. It's kind of like this perfect double bank shot in billiards that Lee Harvey Oswald pulled off with that bolt action rifle. That's what Jeffrey St. Clair was referring to when he said, "I remain an unrepentant magic bullshit man, magic bullet man, whatever." I noticed recently that that makes for a great acronym, unrepentant magic bullet bullshit man. That's an umbum. I like it. An umbum, you know, is a kind of bum, but it also rhymes loosely with humbug. You know, aside from that wonderfully serendipitous acronym, the language St. Clair uses there is fascinating. I mean, it's religious language, right? Well, the guy's still alive, so he could still repent, you know, even on his deathbed. And then we could forgive him, I guess. Well, I wouldn't forgive him. I mean, hell with that. But some of you are more Christian, you know, culturally Christian maybe. So you could forgive him. I mean, if he repented, that is. Begged for forgiveness. It doesn't look like that's happening. For now, he's a still unrepentant magic bullet bullshit man. That's a sum bum. I know this is a serious setting, but nobody said it was against the rules to have a bit of fun. Anyway, I like this umbum term, and I hope nobody objects if I use it henceforth to refer to these people. We know which people we're talking about, right? One point about this is that being an umbum is pretty much completely transversal or orthogonal to any conventional, you know, left-right framing. An umbum can be on the political left, like this Jeffrey St. Clair or Noam Chomsky, or the person can be alt-right or libertarian or something like that. It can be some figure like a Rush Limbaugh who appeals to that angry white man demographic. And in principle, these people hate each other, right? Well, whether they really do or not, I don't know. Maybe it's a bit like professional wrestling, you know, but they're still all umbums. You see, any of these people, regardless of their positioning on some possibly synthetic right-left spectrum, they present themselves as dissidents, rebels with some sort of cause. They're anti-establishment in theory, but at any key juncture, they will always uphold whatever key establishment narrative. Funny how that works. As best I understand it, these umbums play a certain functional role in the propaganda matrix, whether they themselves are aware of it or not, you know, sort of cogs in the system. I kind of think of them as shock absorbers. You see, there is an awful lot of discontent out there, rage of varying sorts. These people's role, as I understand it, is to channel that anger in a direction that is pretty much completely non-threatening to the powers that be. Yeah, it's an oppositional stance of sorts, but it's always going to be this watered-down, weak beer, decaffeinated sort of thing, which is all you can really have if you're always upholding whatever key establishment narratives. I think in practice, a lot of it ends up revolving around these sorts of identity politics issues. Now, personally, since I'm what Jeffrey St. Clair calls a deep stater, my own view is it doesn't matter if you have a black president or a woman president, you know, or a gay president, because the policies aren't going to change as a result. All you do is you change the front man or maybe front woman, and it makes no difference. It's the same people running things. You know, so these umbums, they push things in a basically sterile direction that finally is just a distraction, a waste of emotional energy. You know, like you get all excited and be Obama girl, or you can be Trump boy, you know, fine. You know, maybe a better idea would be to grow up. So to me, that's what characterizes the Umbum agenda, which we could call the Umbumma for short. You know, they uphold the various bullshit narratives, and they're always pushing the discussion in some basically sterile direction. There's a funny story I vaguely recall. I don't even know whether it's true. Some engineering firm in job interviews with recent engineering graduates had asked them some question like, suppose you drop your car keys in the middle of the ocean. How do you solve this problem? You know, something like that. I think the answer is, don't drop your car keys in the middle of the ocean. You know, so I think if the question gets framed as, how do we win these people, these umbums like Jeffrey Sinclair or Chomsky or more conservative or alt-right umbums over to our side, you know, how do we convince them? I think the situation is kind of similar. You're not going to win these people over any more than you are going to retrieve your car keys from the middle of the ocean. Forget about it. I mean, you only have to observe a prominent umbum in action like Chomsky when confronted by 9/11 truth to realize that this is pretty hopeless. You know, it's just these endless sort of blowhard tactics. Though it's not even about Chomsky specifically. I think Upton Sinclair absolutely nailed it, and this must have been like close to 100 years ago, when he said, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. Yeah, I people just get so invested in these false narratives that at some point there's basically zero possibility that they ever will recant. So they become umbums, unrepentant magic bullshit men. I think the way you deal with these people has to be something like cutting off their oxygen. I mean, their air supply is based on the idea that whatever establishment narratives possess some sort of a priori presumption of truth. Our stance, I think, should be to say, look, this is all just storytelling. The magic bullet story and the rest of these magic bullshit stories are just silly stories, and there is no particular reason to believe them. Okay, let's shift tack a bit and talk a bit about storytelling. A story, if it is going to be presented as realistic, I mean, in theory, it should be logically consistent, right? I mean, a big part of this is it has to have a timeline that makes sense. It has to be free of anachronisms, you know, things that don't belong at that point in time. So if you have a story set in Victorian England and somebody whips out a ballpoint pen, you know, that's a problem. That kind of thing would be typical of bad, sloppy storytelling. I guess a more egregious kind of anachronism is when characters say things that just don't correspond to the spirit of the times, you know, the zeitgeist, if you will. Suppose in a narrative set in 1920, some character in the story starts ranting about gay marriage. You know, you can only imagine how people might react to that. Well, of course I'm in favor of gay marriage. I certainly don't think that marriage should be a sad, gloomy affair. Well, I mean, the bottom line is that nobody would know on earth what the person was talking about. You see, people can't know about things before they could possibly know about them. So if a steel frame skyscraper is going to just suddenly disintegrate it, you know, it should probably be reported after it happens, not before. But, never mind. That's just a glitch in the matrix. No, never mind. It's funny, though, how much storytelling, classic storytelling, tends to violate this principle. That's a strange thing. You know, in particular, in fantastical fiction, myths, legends, and what have you, people know things before they could know them. And it is typically via some sort of magical plot device. In the Arthurian legends, how do people recognize that young Arthur is going to be king of Britain one day? Remember that? Excalibur, the sword and the stone. Whoso pulleth the sword out of this here stone is the rightful king. You know, I guess they didn't have DNA testing back then. You know, so young Arthur pulls out the sword, and everybody's like, whoa, this kid is the son of Uther Pendragon and is the rightful king. Yeah, man, and all this time I thought he was son of the milkman. You know, it's a crazy story, but it's also kind of typical of a certain sort of mythical storytelling. No, I mean, the way certain plot devices prefigure the action. I mean, consider Shakespeare's Macbeth. How does Macbeth learn that he will be king of Scotland? Well, as I recall, one day he's in the forest and he runs into Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, and Gina Haspel, and they tell him he will be king. He just has to, kill the current king, no problem. I came, I saw, he died. Actually runs into three witches, not those specific ones, but, that would be an anachronism for sure. But again, if your storytelling is not constrained by real-world limitations, you can just introduce whatever bit of magic, which is somebody finds a crystal ball in the attic. Of course, the propaganda matrix is supposed to be presenting you with realistic narratives that a modern rational person could believe in. Nowadays, when they have one of these terrorist incidents and they know who did it immediately, how do they know? Typically, as they find the person's passport or ID on the scene again and again. I was wondering how many times they'd use this particular plot trope. I found an article by Professor Michel Chosudovsky in globalresearch.ca where he seems to count 7, Barcelona, Manchester, Berlin, Paris, Nice, London, New York. Actually, I think it's more than 7 because I think there were at least 2 in Paris and there might be more than 1 in either New York or London. I'd have to check. Yeah, I mean, it's at least 7. Yeah. The miraculous appearance of the IDs has a few important aspects. I mean, the first obvious point, which is what the truth community would tend to, grab onto, is that the whole story is just so extremely implausible. The terrorists are always leaving their IDs on the scene, in the getaway car or wherever. You'd think it could happen once, maybe, but time after time, so reliably, 7 times in a row or more. Another, I think, more important aspect is that, as far as I can see, finding some ID so conveniently at the crime scene is at least as consistent with the person being set up as a patsy as it is with them being the actual perpetrator. But somehow nobody points that out. From a narrative point of view, storytelling, what is achieved with this is a sort of compression of time. Without the ID conveniently left at the scene, the authorities would have no idea who did this, and presumably there would be a regular criminal investigation, which, like any bureaucratic procedure, could take a while, a long and variable amount of time. A key thing in these sorts of events seems to be that they want to present the story pretty much immediately and establish it in the public mind, and that's that. Oswald did it, Osama bin Laden did it. And then the story never changes. What they certainly don't want is an honest, legitimate investigation of these sorts of events, for obvious reasons. A funny thing, by the way, is that the red pill in the Matrix is also a magical plot device that compresses time. It moves the plot along. If there was no magic red pill, how is Neo supposed to figure out there's a Matrix? I mean, that's kind of intriguing. I guess it would be some complex psychological process. But how would they narrate that in a movie? Finally, if you think about it, it becomes pretty much inevitable that the story would introduce some such magical plot device. We want to get on with the story, get to the slick martial arts scene. So the story writer just says, okay, the heck with all that. There's this red pill scene. He takes it and the plot advances the next stage. The red pill is not really an explanation of anything. Sometimes in these terrorism narratives we're presented, the patsy is said to have self-radicalized. What on earth does that mean? It's just some bullshit term they made up. You could just as well say the person took a red pill or they ran into Hillary Clinton in the woods. So if you look at this problem of the indestructible IDs, it's actually just a storytelling device like the red pill. How do the authorities identify the terrorists? Are we going to tell some complex story about how they deduced this? No, the terrorists left their ID yet again, and we knew who they were the very same day. To anybody who's paying much attention at all, so many of these things have telltale signs that they're nothing more than contrived storytelling. So now I reach a stage where I feel I can finally say something that's practically useful for truth-oriented people, though it behooves me to express it delicately. I've noticed that in the truth community or various truth communities, what they typically do is that they accord the mainstream narrative some initial presumption of truth. And then they gradually pick it apart by showing all the logical and factual inconsistencies. That's what David Ray Griffin does in the new Pearl Harbor and so on. My intention is not to denigrate his work or other people's in saying this, but maybe this is not the best way of going about things. It may be a very long, tortuous way of getting where you want to go. I think where you want to go is to reach the understanding that these things are just stories. I don't know how clear my point is on that, and I was looking for a way to explain the idea. You know, I already mentioned these Arthurian legends, Sword in the Stone. That's an interesting case to examine. As best I can determine, these stories have, to all intents and purposes, zero hard factual basis. I mean, there's no documentary or archaeological record of a king named Arthur who ruled from a place called Camelot. It's all just storytelling, right? You know, so we could consider this little thought experiment. Imagine an Arthurian truth movement, scientists and engineers for Arthurian truths. You know, we've now got 3,000 qualified engineers and scientists who have signed our petition that the Sword in the Stone story is impossible. I am a professor of genetics at the University of Copenhagen, and I can tell you that pulling a sword out of a stone is not a plausible way of establishing somebody's paternity. You know, maybe there's a halfway decent comedy skit there, but there's a serious point here. You know, I put it to you, surely a normal person faced with all this would just say, come on, guys, you can save all this high-powered analysis. I already knew perfectly well that this stuff about Camelot and King Arthur is just a bunch of silly stories. Of course, you know, of course you don't need a PhD in medieval history or whatever field to know this. What this little thought experiment also tells you is, at least in some context, an ordinary person with an ordinary general education is perfectly capable of distinguishing between real history based on real facts and storytelling, which is what these Arthurian legends are, of course, though they can see that in some contexts and in other contexts not. Okay, I don't have much time left. Let's talk about Roger Rabbit. That's a metaphor I use in my own writing over the last couple of years. It's an allusion to a movie from 30 years ago, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, in which cartoon characters and human actors interact in a very seamless manner. It struck me as a useful metaphor for talking about propaganda narratives. I said these things are bad storytelling. Well, to be clear, it's bad if you're trying to create a realistic representation of the real world, but, you know, that you've got these blatantly cartoon constructs inserted into what's supposed to be reality. But if you're just trying to entertain people, that's another matter. For me, I guess the pinnacle of realistic storytelling would be these great panoramic novels of the 19th century, like, you know, War and Peace or something. And those things have a large cast of characters who are complex, realistic people. They're not perfectly good or perfectly evil, you know, but that's high-end literature. The propaganda narratives we are being presented are, by and large, nothing like this. You have those fake beheading videos with characters like Jihadi John and Jihadi Joseph, who really are like cartoon villains. Unlike the aforementioned novels, you're being presented with characters and situations that really correspond to a cartoon world. I don't know when precisely it first dawned on me that Osama bin Laden, as he is presented to us, what he most resembles is some sort of villain from a James Bond movie. The Saudi multimillionaire who lives in a cave in Afghanistan, and from there he orchestrates these deadly terrorist attacks around the world. And isn't this just like a character out of a fantastical fiction? Actually, I dare say that if you analyze bin Laden simply as a fictional character, albeit pulp fiction, he is, if anything, more compelling than most any of the James Bond villains. Dr. No, Goldfinger. Though portrayed by human actors, these Bond villains, like Bond himself, are really like cartoon characters. The foregoing observations could, at first blush, be perceived as little more than empty sarcasm. However, on reflection, there is more to it than that. We could even talk of an alternative framing of the question, the Roger Rabbit framing, if you will. And it could be interesting to contrast this with a more conventional truth community approach. The conventional approach revolves, at least initially, around educating people about various technical issues. With 9/11, the characteristics of a controlled demolition, with the various assassination research, technical facts about firearms and ballistics. These are things about which, generally speaking, people don't have any prior knowledge. Very few people do anyway. I grant that it's not too hard to get sufficiently educated about these things. A person with a reasonable high school education should be able to do so, but they still have to do it. By contrast, the Roger Rabbit framing is based on something about which everybody is already effectively an expert. Everybody, even children, even absolutely uneducated, illiterate people can, with absolute reliability, watch a Roger Rabbit sort of movie and immediately identify which elements on the screen are real and which are cartoons. Interestingly, this is a very egalitarian situation because everybody's judgment on that sort of question is about equally good. No issue of being a qualified architect or engineer or any such thing. Now, this approach is potentially provocative. For example, if you tell people that Bin Laden is a cartoon character, they could get their backs up. This man murdered 3,000 of my fellow Americans on 9/11. How dare you say that this is a cartoon character? One will surely face that. But on the other hand, it really may resonate with people in a way that the conventional approach does not. There really is a deep truth there. You know, deep truth, the name of this very event, which is that so many of these propaganda scenarios have aspects that correspond much more to a cartoon universe than the real world. Now, to be clear, in none of this am I saying that the conventional approach is invalid. Certainly, if there was a new official investigation, I mean an honest investigation into 9/11, for example, the case to be made would center on the forensic evidence from the architects and engineers. That's what you would use if you wanted to build a case that would prevail in a court of law, not any Roger Rabbit framing of the question. However, we don't have that honest official investigation going. I have no idea if or when we ever will. If it's a question of what approach is effective sitting around the kitchen table with family and friends, the answer might be entirely different. An important aspect of the Roger Rabbit approach, which is saying, look, guys, these are just cartoons, is that it does not accord the establishment narrative any initial presumption of truth. It is in this sense that the Roger Rabbit framing is arguably more subversive than the conventional truth or approach. You see, one very basic tactical mistake people make is that they get maneuvered into a position where they are supposed to prove a negative. You know, meanwhile, the people on the other side of the debate don't need to prove anything. I mean, consider this fake news meme. If there's fake news, then there must be real news. And what's the real news? Well, obviously, it's the establishment narrative. That's what possesses a presumption of truth. That's the game. Know thy enemy. Study the various prominent umbums, how they operate. In any of these key spots, an umbum will never accept that there is any onus on him to prove anything. Of course not. Jeffrey St. Clair cannot prove the magic bullet story because obviously it's just some far-fetched story somebody made up. Well, we know who made up that story, this guy Arlen Specter, who was later a fixture in the U.S. Senate. The magic bullshit man never accepts that he needs to prove his story. The onus is always on you to prove something. So the Roger Rabbit framing is just to say, guys, we're not playing your game. So it can sound kind of fun and whimsical, but there is a hard edge here. It is tantamount to saying, guys, these things are cartoons. When are you pathetic fools going to grow up? Magic bullets, magic indestructible passports. Stop already with these children's stories. Time now for a concluding wrap-up. What all of the foregoing remarks about storytelling and cartoons mixed with reality are really getting at is something I think most of you have come upon this talk already knew on some level. Though you might have had a hard time putting your finger on it, it certainly took me a while, and I don't know how clear I am expressing it even now. We are operating in a very degraded intellectual culture. In a sane, mentally hygienic environment, people expressing belief in cartoons would be discrediting themselves. They wouldn't just cease to be public intellectuals. They'd end up in a rubber room. But that's actually our public intellectual cast, our intelligentsia, by and large. It's these umbums, the unrepentant believers in cartoons. It's this bizarro inverted world. We are being presented all these cartoons, these Roger Rabbit narratives. And if you say they are cartoons, you are the one who is going to get publicly ridiculed and treated as an unserious person. So what's the solution to this? Well, I guess don't have an intellectual culture like this. Yeah, don't throw your car keys in the middle of the ocean. But here we are, so now what? As I see it, we need to have an intellectual culture in which somebody being taken in by an obvious hoax loses credibility. Really, about the most important job requirement for a public intellectual should be the ability to distinguish real facts from storytelling. Imagine somebody showed up to the history department at Harvard and started talking about Camelot like this is a real place and King Arthur and Lancelot like they were real historical figures. He'd be discrediting himself. Earlier I talked about timeline. Let's consider a little timeline. A woman suddenly takes an interest in strollers and baby clothes. Suddenly she's talking about nothing else. She then becomes visibly pregnant and then later gives birth. A naive child living next door observes this and concludes that the woman became so interested in baby clothes and such that this caused her to become pregnant. Now, we adults understand what happened. Obviously, the woman finds out she's pregnant, is going to be a mother, and that is the cause of her sudden interest in the baby clothes. But it's only after that that she becomes visibly pregnant, you know, her belly gets big, right? So consider the conventional mainstream explanation of 9/11. The attacks occur. Why? Because they hate us for our freedoms or whatever bullshit story. And as a result of being attacked, we go off to war, Afghanistan, then Iraq. In short, 9/11 caused the wars, right? Well, that's utter nonsense, of course. 9/11 occurred because the deep state, or more precisely some faction of it, wanted those wars. To get what they wanted, an enabling event like 9/11 was necessary. So the desire for the wars is what caused 9/11 to happen. 9/11 didn't cause the wars. Really, in deep structure, to believe that 9/11 caused the wars is no different from the little child who thinks that a woman's pregnancy was caused by her sudden interest in baby clothes, rather than the other way around. So all these umbums, our beloved public intellectual class, properly understood, are trying to enforce an understanding of the world that is fundamentally infantile. Cartoons. Okay, this is about the end. The talk has gone full cycle and is ending approximately where it began. It is that somehow, as individuals and collectively as a society, we are just so helpless against this kind of stuff. At some point, we have to take stock of this and figure out why. I think a lot of this pertains to a sort of I'm okay, you're okay, let's agree to disagree sort of vibe. This Roger Rabbit framing could seem playful and fun, but it has a hard edge because it has some real implications. No, we're not going to politely agree to disagree with these umbums about whether Simba the Lion King is a real lion or not, because there is no intermediate compromise position on this. On other questions on a left-right spectrum, like immigration or minimum wage or progressive income tax, there actually is a range of workable intermediate positions, and people from different ideological positions could sit around a table and do some horse trading. But whether a cartoon is a cartoon or not is not really negotiable. People who broadly agree with my framing on these issues, we have to find one another and build a community that is really based on an adult understanding of the world, that we reject the cartoons. Personally, I feel that we should not waste too much time and energy trying to get along with the various umbums or even worry about them too much. Well, I'll close things here. Thanks for listening. Thank you to the people who organized this conference.
We'll have questions later on.